This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Pariskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Mathalu alladhina yunfiquna amwalahum fi sabilillah كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi repeats Tehran's call for the formation of an all-inclusive government in Afghanistan. France recalls its envoys to the U.S. and Australia and blasts the U.K. after Canberra dished an arms deal with Paris in favor of an alliance with Washington and London. And the U.S. Capitol is on high alert on the eve of a rally by former President Donald Trump supporters who stormed the Capitol building 8 months ago. Thanks for joining us. Iran and Tajikistan have called for the formation of an all-inclusive government in Afghanistan in the wake of the Taliban takeover of that country last month. The presidents of the two countries issued the call during a joint press conference in the Tajik capital, Dushanbe. Iran's Ebrahim Raisi said that a government comprised of one political or ethnic group cannot resolve problems in the country. He also said that terrorist groups in Afghanistan must be taken out, as they pose a threat to the whole region. The Tajik president, Emomali Rahman, said that peace and stability should be restored in the war-stricken nation for the sake of regional security. He warned that an escalation of violence could lead to humanitarian disaster for Afghanistan and turn it into a hub for terrorism in the region. Munir Ahmad is a senior journalist and political analyst who joins us from Islamabad. Welcome. When you take a look at this government that Afghanistan has formed, the Taliban, it's not an all-inclusive government, and there are calls for it to be one. The Taliban has responded by saying this could be just an interim political makeup, so to speak. How do you view the way that this government is formed and the Taliban's response?
Thank you very much. Initially, we were expecting that the Taliban, as they were giving their intentions to form an inclusive government, but end of the day we saw that they have excluded all the factions and all the ethnic groups from the government. And they call it, this is the interim government, but we believe that it is not the interim setup, but this would continue, and this is the beginning of their long-term regime. And they will not have a very inclusive government, and most of the geopolitical analysts believe like their takeover to all over Afghanistan was well scripted, and the present interim government is also scripted. I think Taliban should take their own decision, and they should not follow the script if they really want to have good relations with the neighborhood. And of course, everyone in the neighborhood is interested to strengthen Taliban government. But the internal politics depends on different factions and ethnic groups. And only Taliban cannot rule it with all a peaceful future. And recently we have also seen like different bomb blasts over there and security issues. They also promised to give rights to women, and they would have right to education, and they have right to their work, but they have started imposing a different sort of restrictions on their population. And their intentions are very clear, and they have no measures taken to include different factions. And what they have spoken to China, Iran, Turkey, and Pakistan, and unfortunately, at the moment we see, they are not fulfilling their commitments or what they have said to take care of with the neighborhood and bilateral and multilateral relations within the region. So this would create more chaos and more frustration among the other factions. And once like it is now clear their takeover to their takeover of Afghanistan was very much scripted, that and how the United States of America had given space to them to take over, and now with the a notion coming from America that there is the fears of rise of Al-Qaeda, it means like another script is on the way. So given all the situation, if Afghanistan and the regional countries like to have peace in the region and stable Afghanistan, Taliban should take care of all the notions. They are coming from the neighborhood because everyone is interested to strengthen Taliban regime. But if it is inclusive, it would have synergy of all the political factions and all the support from a neighborhood, including Iran, Pakistan, China, and Turkey, and Russia as well. So if they exclude their factions internally, external support would definitely diminish, and it would decrease the possibilities of their success within Afghanistan. Yes, please.
Okay, thank you very much for that. We do appreciate it. That is Munir Ahmad, senior journalist and political analyst there from Islamabad. Many thanks. Moving on, the U.S. military admits a drone strike that it carried out late last month in Afghanistan killed civilians and not Daesh terrorists.
It is further my assessment that the strike team were convinced at the time of the strike that the area was clear of civilians and that they had taken prudent steps in regards to weaponizing the strike to minimize the potential for civilian casualties. Finally, it is my assessment that they did believe, as reported, that there was a secondary explosion. Our investigation now concludes that the strike was a tragic mistake.
General McKenzie said that the U.S. intelligence had, quote, reasonable certainty that the suspected location was a Daesh position where terrorists were planning an attack on Kabul Airport. McKenzie put the death toll from the airstrike at 10, including 7 children. The U.S. had said that it was retaliating against the deadly August 26 bombing of the airport. The attack, which was claimed by Daesh, killed over 180 people, including 13 American service members. The strike came as Afghan and foreign nationals were rushing to leave Afghanistan. Activist and commentator Sarah Flounders says the U.S. made no mention of reparations for killing civilians in Afghanistan.
It's come through when the whole world already knows, and knows it through photo and images and visits and interviews. However, it says nothing about the literally hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians who've been killed in U.S. wars. No mention of reparations. Instead, how to further starve down the people of Afghanistan through sanctions, through cutting off every ounce of funds, through taking Afghanistan's own money and leaving them penniless without food as winter is coming on. So this is cruelty and terror in an organized way, and they've been forced to concede that this last drone attack was a mistake. But we should be clear that already it's been admitted that 8 out of 10 of U.S. drone attacks, and there have been more than 14,000 U.S. drone attacks, Hellfire missiles fired. 8 out of 10 of them are mistakes.
France has recalled its ambassadors to the U.S. and Australia amid anger over Canberra's new security pact with Washington and London that scrapped a submarine deal with Paris. The French foreign minister says that President Emmanuel Macron recalled the envoys due to the exceptional seriousness of the recent event. Washington has regretted Paris's decision, saying that it will try to resolve the differences in the coming days. Meanwhile, a French diplomatic source has criticized London for acting in a, quote, opportunistic manner. The row followed Australia's announcement on Thursday that it would ditch a deal to buy French submarines worth $40 billion in favor of a new arrangement with the U.S. and the U.K. to acquire nuclear-powered submarines, dubbed AUKUS. France had already called the abandonment of the deal a stab in the back. The U.S. Capitol is on high alert on the eve of a rally by former President Donald Trump's supporters who stormed the Capitol building 8 months ago.
There have been some threats of violence associated with the events for tomorrow, and we have a strong plan in place to ensure that it remains peaceful and that if violence does occur, that we can stop it as quickly as possible. We're not going to tolerate violence, and we will not tolerate criminal behavior of any kind.
Police expressed concern about the possibility of counter-protesters making it to the pro-Trump rally. Security forces have reinstalled the fence that surrounded the Capitol for 6 months after the January unrest. The National Guard is also on alert. Protesters say that the rally is on behalf of people arrested during the unrest on charges other than violence against the police and the destruction of property. January 6th saw thousands of Trump supporters, including white supremacists, storm Congress building to impede Joe Biden's confirmation as president. 5 people were killed and some 600 arrested during the violence. The United States has imposed sanctions on several individuals and entities linked to the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah and Iran. The U.S. Treasury Department said it is designating Lebanon and Kuwait-based financial conduits that fund Hezbollah. It also targeted alleged financial facilitators and front companies that support the resistance group and the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. Hong Kong-based companies and individuals residing in China were among those sanctioned. The U.S. deems Hezbollah to be a terrorist group. It has sanctioned several Hezbollah members, including its leader and deputy leader. Hezbollah Chief Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah has dismissed the sanctions, saying that the U.S. will not be able to harm the resistance. Political commentator Ramiro Funes says that Hezbollah and Iran have been at the forefront of fighting real terrorists who have been spreading chaos and extremism in the region.
Hezbollah and the Lebanese resistance is by no means a terrorist group. In fact, Hezbollah and Iran have been at the forefront of defeating the real terrorists in the region in the Middle East, ISIS, Daesh, United States, Israel. These are the real terroristic forces in the Middle East. And this is why in Lebanon, in Iraq, in Yemen, in Iran, the anti-imperialist resistance has been growing, the axis of resistance. And these are the brave men and women who have been on the front lines against the real terrorists who have been spreading chaos and extremism in the region. And this is pure hypocrisy because Hezbollah, Iran, Daesh, Hezbollah and the Lebanese resistance, they have a common enemy with the U.S., which is terrorism, which is extremism. And to brand Hezbollah as a terrorist group, to sanction individuals for supporting a heroic anti-imperialist struggle, is just pure hypocrisy. So I think on many fronts, this just represents the overall double standards of U.S. empire.
International Organization for Migration has expressed concern over the disappearance of thousands of Europe-bound migrants who were intercepted and returned to Libya. UN body spokesperson Safa Michelli said that more than 24,000 migrants have been intercepted by Libyan coast guards this year so far. She added, however, only 6,000 have been accounted for in the country's official detention centers. She said the whereabouts of thousands of others remain unknown, saying that they might be subject to trafficking or extortion for release. Libya has long been a hub for African and Middle Eastern migrants fleeing war and poverty in their countries. Those returned to shore are taken to Libya's government-run detention centers, where they are often held in miserable conditions facing abuse. Algeria's former president Abdelaziz Bouteflika has died at the age of 84. He served as president for almost 20 years, from 1999 until his resignation in 2019. Afterwards, he spent the rest of his days in a medicalized residence in a suburb of Algiers. during the Algerian War for Independence from France in the 1950s. He served as a member of Algeria's National Liberation Front. After Algeria gained its independence, Bouteflika served as the Minister of Foreign Affairs from 1963 to 1979. He also served as President of the UN General Assembly during the 1974-75 session. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas warns Israel about the consequences of its crimes against Palestinians held in the regime's prisons. Hamas vowed to liberate the Palestinian inmates recaptured after escaping from Israel's Gilboa prison. It said the inmates will be part of any exchange deal in the future. The movement described the Gilboa prison break the latest in a series of failures suffered by Israel's security, military, and political system. On September the 6th, six Palestinian inmates fled the high-security prison through a hole reportedly dug with a spoon. The later rearrest of four of the inmates sparked protests across the occupied territories in solidarity with Palestinians held in Israeli prisons. The regime has toughened restrictions on Palestinian inmates and their families since the jailbreak. People have held Friday prayers in front of the Red Cross office in the Gaza Strip in support of Palestinian prisoners languishing in Israeli jails. Ruba Shabi has more from Gaza.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip took part in Friday prayer in front of the headquarters of the Red Cross. The event, organized by different Palestinian factions, aims to support Palestinian prisoners who are subjected to Israeli abuse.
We are here to stress that we will not disappoint our Palestinian prisoners and we will keep supporting them. Our prisoners are passing through difficult times inside the jails as the regime is attacking the prisoners, especially Islamic Jihad members.
Meanwhile, Palestinians consider the recent heroic escape operation of six prisoners from an Israeli jail as a slap in the face of Israel.
We are doing our best to release Palestinian prisoners, and this is an oath that we should stick with until all Palestinian inmates are free. We are working round the clock to hold meetings and put plans so we can liberate our prisoners and have them run us and with their families. Our resistance made a firm decision that the six Palestinian inmates that escaped Gilboa prison are on top of any coming exchange deal.
The Palestinian resistance mentors the behavior of the Israeli regime towards the prisoners inside the jails and those who remain free, demanding the international institutions to put pressure on Israel regarding the prisoners' issue.
The issue of our inmates inside Israeli jails is ongoing, and there are still two of the six heroic escapees out of the Israeli prison. We are here to express our total support for those inmates and all Palestinian prisoners who are fighting to achieve their demands.
Palestinians here stress they will remain committed to their duty of supporting prisoners and demanding their release. The issue of Palestinian inmates is a priority for Palestinians who will keep demanding their release until they regain complete freedom. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
And that does it for World News.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite, words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger, to let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately, to help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
In the limelight.
For 1,500 Palestinian people in the Al Bustan quarter of Silwan threatened with displacement and demolition, the pile of rubble represents the remnants of a much larger fight against the Israeli regime's efforts to expel Palestinians from the area, says Kelly Kunzel, writer in an article titled "Zionist Regime Bulldozers Bring Heartbreak to Silwan." Stay tuned for the second part of this article, please. From 1991 to 2019, the Israeli regime-controlled Al-Quds municipality issued more than 21,000 permits for the construction of Jewish settlement units in East Al-Quds, while less than 10,000 were allotted for Palestinians. The number of structures demolished in East Al-Quds rose by 44% in June this year, compared with the previous 5 months. Illegal touristic endeavors in Silwan, pioneered by Ilad, also include excavations for the City of David Park project. The underground tunnels have left Palestinian homes in the area crumbling since they were first dug in 2000. Hapler, the director of the Committee Against Demolition, said, "Archaeology is part of the Judaization process also. You can dig and destroy all the layers until you get down to the ancient Israelite layer to show the tourists. In this way, they can erase all the Palestinian history down to the history Israel wants to highlight." The most recent demolitions in Silwan came after the municipality rejected new zoning plans put forth for the third time by residents. Fakhri Abu Diab, a prominent community activist in Silwan, told the Electronic Intifada. Residents worked with Yusuf Jabarin, an urban planning professor at Technion in Haifa, to develop a new outline for the neighborhood. Its purpose was to allow optimal space for development in order to accommodate a growing population, as per a spoken agreement with the municipality to extend the demolition freeze. The neighborhood collectively spent $500,000 on plans. Abu Diab said, putting forward a different design each time. When residents pressed the municipality on why the outlines continued to be rejected, they were only told that the ruling came from the Israeli regime's interior ministry. Abu Diab said, "This proves that the permits are just excuses. It is clearly a political situation." Zionist regime authorities are also threatening to demolish Abu Diab's home in Al-Bustan, where his wife, 5 children, and 12 grandchildren live. The Israeli regime authorities denied Abu Diab building permits 7 times, forcing him to build a 2-room extension to his own home without Israeli permits. Despite the addition, living conditions are still cramped. "If you will go inside and look at it, it will look like a refugee camp with so many people. It's not enough room at all. But we have no other option," Abu Diab said. Abu Diab added, "Am I going to sleep in the streets just so they can build a garden over my house? Every day here we say this may be the last night sleeping in our homes. Israeli regime forces may come tomorrow and destroy it. If we don't do it ourselves, the municipality will charge us 1,000 shekels per meter of what they demolish." Since June 29th, Israeli regime forces have attacked Palestinians protesting the demolition with rubber-coated steel bullets and tear gas, injuring at least 19. In scenes reminiscent of the ongoing situation in adjacent neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, where Israeli regime forces have continued to brutally police Palestinian residents protesting a complete takeover of their homes by settlers, Silwan was also declared a closed military zone on July 20th. The Zionist regime forces installed checkpoints on roads entering and exiting the neighborhood, further restricting freedom of movement for Palestinians in the city. Abu Diab told the Electronic Intifada, "The situation is very awful. Every day someone is arrested. Every day these are clashes, police are giving fines, and every other day there is the sound of rubber bullets. I wouldn't let my kids go out after 7 p.m. because they may be arrested or shot. So desperate is the situation that Palestinians are demolishing their own homes to avoid being landed with a bill if the Zionist regime carried out the demolition." So far this year, 45% of demolitions have been carried out by their owners, a 27% increase from the previous 5 years. The increase has been attributed to new legislation that gives the Israeli regime-controlled Al-Quds municipality the power to exert pressure on families to demolish their own structures, according to the UN monitoring group OCHA. The Zionist regime has demolished and confiscated more than 670 Palestinian structures in the occupied West Bank since the beginning of the year, displacing nearly 1,000 people. Almost half of those displaced were children. This includes 116 structures in occupied East Al-Quds, where more than 200 people have been displaced. Residents have engaged in public art projects in the neighborhood and communal dinners as another form of protest. Amani Odeh also organizes weekly gatherings for youth activists. Odeh held back tears as she told the teens at one such recent meeting, "There is an old folk tale that says Silwan is a well that you drink from and forget your heartbreak."
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Over the past few years, the United Arab Emirates has tried to project itself as a land of wealth and luxury. The Persian Gulf state has been alluring many from across the world to pursue their dreams in this part of the world. As part of its branding strategy, Abu Dhabi is now giving golden visas to international celebrities, a 10-year renewable residency. Yet the other side of the story is not that golden.
Arab.
Lebanese singer Najwa Karam, legendary footballer Cristiano Ronaldo, Egyptian actor Nelly Karim, and Tajik influencer Abdul Razak all have one thing in common. Apart from their fame and wealth, they're all in possession of the UAE Golden Visa, a win-win for everyone. For the UAE, the presence of these celebrities helps the Emiratis raise their country's profile as a desirable destination.
I also know that they've granted, UAE passports to over 200 Israelis, which is concerning because that would allow the Israelis to travel through anywhere in the Middle East, any Arab country, and that seems to be also, a dangerous exercise to allow Israelis to get access to UAE passports when the Palestinian issue and other problems like Israeli violations of Lebanese airspace, attacks on Syria, are still there. And I think this should not be allowed, and the Arab world should work together to try to address those concerns and not simply try to ingratiate themselves to the Israelis.
Last year, when Egyptian singer and actor Mohammed Ramadan was granted the visa, he posted on Instagram, "Thank you to the ruler of Dubai, Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid, may God preserve him, for the most beautiful gift of the golden visa. May God bless the rulers and the population." Indian actor Shahrukh Khan, Canada-born fashion Instagrammer Ola Farahad, and Lebanese pop singer Maryam Fares are also among the dozens of international celebrities who received the visa and posted special thanks online. Abu Dhabi introduced the Golden Visa in 2019 as part of its strategy to develop its entertainment industry and attract foreign investment while refreshing its appearance with the presence of A-list celebrities in the UAE.
Well, I think it's a public relations exercise and, to present a good image for the United Arab Emirates, because they do have a lot of problems. There's lots of dissidents that are in prison. And it's perhaps also a way to attract entertainers and other people to the United Arab Emirates and try to expand the entertainment sector.
Meanwhile, handing these celebrities the golden visa on a silver platter has triggered a backlash in a country where its women are still unable to pass down citizenship to their children. In the words of Sophia Kaltenbrenner of International Campaign for Freedom in the UAE, "The UAE is free to attract foreign investment by extending Emirati citizenship laws, but it should end the gross discrimination regarding women and stateless groups." Whereas the slightest criticism might be punished with a prison sentence in the UAE, outstanding figures have begun criticizing citizenship laws. For example, Sheikha Jawahir Al-Ghassimi, the wife of the ruler of Sharjah, tweeted earlier this year, "Naturalization for the children of female citizens, a demand. Jobs for the children of the Emiratis, a demand," alluding to the existing discrimination against Emirati mothers with foreign husbands. Emirati citizenship laws also discriminate against a Bedouin or stateless population who are entirely excluded from obtaining Emirati nationality, no matter how long they have lived in the UAE. Many Bedouin have spent all their lives on Emirati soil, and often have there since before the creation of the UAE in 1971. According to Laura Van Was, the coordinator of the Institute on Statelessness and Inclusion, ISI, such discrimination runs counter to international human rights law and has a knock-on effect on the child's enjoyment of other basic rights, as well as on the family as a whole.
It's definitely discriminatory and very heavy-handed and authoritarian, where people who express, their opinions or have, some sort of political dissent, the UAE is revoking their citizenship and therefore leaving them stateless. And also this is a policy of intimidation to sort of attack the relatives of such people in order to silence dissent. In the short term, this does not really prevent the problems, it only hides them. But in the long term, it's actually going to create dissent, create more anger and resentment for the regime, because they're punishing people by revoking their citizenship. This is a very serious measure, and is condemned around the world, because you shouldn't revoke citizenship from people simply for exercising their political rights or for speaking out.
Critics say the UAE Golden Visa is part of the country's PR campaign to portray itself as a modern, open, and tolerant state. In reality, the UAE is one of the most repressive states in the MENA region, with an estimated 200 political prisoners behind bars in the country. Many prisoners' families have been stripped of their citizenship to intimidate them into silence. That can be disastrous for prisoners' relatives. All of a sudden, getting a job, earning a pension, education, and even accessing health care becomes near impossible. The late Ala al-Sadiq, daughter of political prisoner Muhammad al-Sadiq, is a case in point. Ala gained asylum in the UK in 2018 after being driven out of the UAE following a campaign against dissidents between 2011 and 2012. The UAE government stripped Ala and her 9 siblings of their citizenship in March 2016, after her father's citizenship was also revoked.
It's definitely discriminatory and very heavy-handed and authoritarian, where people who express, you know, their opinions or have, you know, some sort of political dissent, UAE is revoking their citizenship and therefore leaving them stateless. And also, this is a policy of intimidation to sort of attack the relatives of such people in order to silence dissent. In the short term, this does not really prevent the problems, it only hides them. But in the long term, it's actually going to create dissent, create more anger and resentment for the regime, because they're punishing people by revoking their citizenship. This is a very serious measure and is condemned around the world, because you shouldn't revoke citizenship from people simply for exercising their political rights or for speaking out.
Recently, the Emirati authorities have promised to shelter 5,000 Afghan refugees in the wake of the recent developments in Afghanistan. A good PR exercise per se. Many observers have taken the promise with a pinch of salt, given the grave reality back in the UAE.
Very surprising that the UAE would offer to take in 5,000 Afghan refugees, because most of their policies and actions don't support that sort of humanitarian initiative. So I would be surprised if the UAE actually does follow through with it. It's a good move, it's good for public relations, but they have to follow through, and the UAE needs citizens and people to work in its country, because it relies so extensively on expatriates to do much of the work. And I think it's a very positive step, but it's out of character for them when you're revoking citizenship and punishing people and then taking in Afghan refugees. It's a surprise, quite frankly, and I hope they do follow through with it. But I suspect that they may come up with some sort of reasons to block it, because there's not many other people, like the Badoons, that should be given citizenship in the UAE and are not given citizenship.
Like many other things in the UAE, golden visas provide the country with a shiny veneer over dark matters Abu Dhabi likes to conceal. Things are not always as bright as they seem in this Persian Gulf state.
In the limelight.
While Europe's right-wing parties remain committed to the ridiculous and baseless notion that Muslims, immigrants, and refugees pose a threat to Europe's overall security and unique secular identities, the left is not entirely immune from such chauvinistic notions, says Ramzi Barut, journalist, in an article published under the heading Progress or War, on Islamophobia and Europe's Demographic Shifts. stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Europe's identity crisis is not confined to the ceaseless squabbles by Europeans over the EU, Brexit, or football. It goes much deeper, reaching sensitive and dangerous territory, including that of culture and religion. Once more, Muslims stand at the heart of the continent's identity debate. Of course, anti-Muslim sentiments are rarely framed to appear anti-Muslim. While Europe's right-wing parties remain committed to the ridiculous and baseless notion that Muslims, immigrants, and refugees pose a threat to Europe's overall security and unique secular identities, the left is not entirely immune from such chauvinistic notions. The right's political discourse is familiar and is often condemned for its repugnantly ultra-nationalistic, if not outright racist, tone and rhetoric. The left, on the other hand, is a different story. The European left, notably in countries like France and Belgium, framed their problem with Islam as fundamental to their supposed dedication to the secular values of the state. A problem arises when, in the name of religion, some want to separate themselves from the Republic and therefore not respect its laws, Macron said during a speech in October 2020. Leftist politicians and intellectuals were just as eager as the right to prevent Ihsan Houch, a Belgian government representative, from serving as a commissioner at the Institute for the Equality of Women and Men, IEFH. Again, both sides joined forces, although without an official declaration of unity, to ensure Houch had no place in the country's democratic process. It was a repeat of a similar scenario in France last May, when Sarah Zemahi was removed from the ruling party's candidates list for seemingly violating France's valeur de la République, or the values of the Republic. These are but mere examples and are badly and hardly restricted to French-speaking countries. There are many such disquieting events pointing to a deep-seated problem that remains unresolved. In Britain, Rachia Ismail was celebrated as the country's first hijab-wearing mayor in May 2019, resigned from her post less than a year and a half later, citing racism and marginalization. While the Belgian, French, and British media elaborated on these stories as if unique to each specific country, in truth, they are all related. Indeed, they are all the outcome of an overriding phenomenon of an anti-Muslim prejudice coupled with a wave of racism that has plagued Europe for many years, especially in the last decade. Though Europe's official institutions, mainstream media, sports clubs, and so on continue to pay lip service to the need for diversity and inclusion, the reality on the ground is entirely different. A recent example was the horrific outcome of England's defeat in the Euro 2020 final against Italy. Gangs of white English, mostly males, attacked people of color, especially black people, whether on the street or online. The extent of cyberbullying, in particular targeting dark-skinned athletes, is almost unprecedented in country's recent history. Various British officials, including Prime Minister Boris Johnson, condemned the widespread racism. Interestingly, many of these officials have said or done very little to combat anti-Muslim hate and violence in the past, which often targeted Muslim women for their head or face covering. Strikingly, Johnson, purportedly now leading the anti-racist charge, was one of the most disparaging officials who spoke demandingly of Muslim women in the past. Of course, Islamophobia must be seen within the larger context of the toxic anti-refugee and anti-immigrant sentiments, now defining factors in shaping modern European politics. It is this hate and racism that served as the fuel for rising political parties like Le Front National in France, Vlaams Belang in Belgium, the Freedom Party in Austria, and the Liga in Italy. In fact, there is a whole intellectual discourse complete with brand new theories that are used to channel yet more hate, violence, and racism against immigrants. And where is the left in all of this? With a few exceptions, much of the left is still trapped in its own intellectual hobby, adding yet more fuel to the fire, while veiling their criticism of Islam as if genuine concern for the secularism. Oddly, in Europe, as in much of the West, crosses and stars of David as necklaces or the Catholic nun's head covering, Velo del Sor, let alone the kippahs, their religious tattoos, and many other such symbols are all part of Europe's everyday culture. Why do we never hear of such controversy of a Jewish man being tossed out of a public building because of his kippah or a white French woman being expelled from university for wearing a cross? The matter has less to do with religious symbols in general than of the religious symbols of races and peoples who are simply unwanted in Europe. Also, limiting the discussion to refugees and immigrants may give the impression that the debate is mostly concerned with the non-European others who are invading Europe's shores, determined to replace Europe's original white Christian inhabitants. This is hardly the case, since a sizable percentage of Belgians and French, for example, are themselves Muslims, estimated at 6% and 5% respectively. Namely, these Muslims are European citizens. Ouch, Zemahi and Ismail actually wanted to be a part of, not break apart from, these societies by honoring their country's most cherished political traditions, yet without erasing their own cultural heritage and religious identities in the process. Alas, they were all vehemently rejected, as if Europe has made a collective decision to ensure that Muslims subsist in the margins forever. And when Muslim communities try to fight back using Europe's own judicial system as their supposed saviors, they are once again rejected. The latest of such spans was in June, when Belgium's constitutional court resolved that prohibiting the wearing of hijab does not constitute a violation of freedom of religion or the right to education. It is time for European countries to understand that their demographics are fundamentally changing, and that such change can, in fact, be beneficial to the health of these nations. Without the true diversity and meaningful inclusion, there can be no real progress in any society anywhere. But while demographic shifts can offer an opportunity for growth, it can also inspire fear, racism, and predictably violence as well. Europe, which has fought two horrendous wars in the last century, should know better.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran, all big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio and to the program Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss problems and issues parents face when raising their children in an Islamic way. As usual, all of our answers are based upon the Holy Quran and the narrations of the Prophet and his household, peace be upon them all. Joining us in the studio is our guest speaker and dear friend, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. We are still discussing how to correctly fix the mistakes of our children, and we've mentioned a few things these past few programs, one of them being that we need to have the children face responsibility and to make them understand the actions and also to feel sympathetic towards them. Dear Sayyid, please enlighten us further.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجه. We are trying to look at simple yet easy ways that we can fix the mistakes of our children without having to break their personality or traumatize them or give them a long life illness that they might not recover from.
Right.
When it comes to dealing with the mistakes of the child, we need to diagnose the disease itself, not the side effects. For example, a child might come to his parents and pretend that he's being bullied or he's being hit by a student or by a teacher, or he pretend that he's sick so you can show him a bit of affection and care. Right, so some children do that. Some kids do that. They try to, if they feel like they're lacking affection from the parents, they do these kind of things. They lie basically to get affection. So instead of trying to fix the lying, which is a side effect, fix the problem, which is the lack of affection.
Right.
So I try to diagnose the problem, not the side effect. Imagine going to the doctor saying, "I have a headache," and the doctor just gives you pain for your headache. Well, headache, as doctors would know, it's a side effect of many diseases. It could be, you could have low blood pressure. It could be high blood pressure. It could be your arm or your nostrils. It could be a disease that you have that the side effect of that disease is a headache. The sign of it is a headache.
Right.
So if the doctor gives you, he says to him, "Look, I have pain in my head. I have a headache," and he just gives you a tablet, then know that this doctor is stupid.
Right.
He should at first try to find what the problem is. What's causing this headache? The headache is just a sign. It's not a disease by itself.
It's a symptom in itself. It's not the key problem.
It's a symptom. It's not a disease. So that would be stupid to do the same diagnosis with a child who, for example, lies to seek attention, and he tries to fix the lying and neglecting the problem itself. So always when you try to diagnose the problem, diagnose the problem itself, not the side effect, not the symptoms, not the effects that take form after the child does a stupid thing, which is again, it's very easy, but yet most parents don't pay attention to it.
Right.
So instead
overlooked.
So instead of saying to him, don't you dare do that again, give him money, see what his problem is, help him out. I remember many stories with my childhood, with other kids of my in my neighborhood. We kind of lacked I mean, due to the circumstances that we kind of were living in, the environment we were in, most of the time our parents were never available, and we kind of lacked that kind of love, that compassion from a parent. And most of the times we found ourselves trying to cheat our way by acting sick and, you know, trying to...
To get some affection.
Yeah, to get some affection. So that needs to be fixed, not the lying.
Makes sense. They said I must interrupt you because we will be taking a quick break.
When I was born, the first words that I had heard were the words of Allah being whispered through my ear. And as I felt Allah's presence in my soul, that day Islam took me in its fold.
Dear listeners, welcome back to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we're discussing how we should correctly fix the mistakes of our children. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
Again, another point that we need to raise is that when kids make mistakes, we need to remind them of the future, not the past. So, for example, if we had guests and the child acted stupid or wrong, next time we want them to help, we want to help them fix that problem,